Great. Well, I'm Kim Strong from the University of Toronto, and I'd like to spend the next 25, 30 minutes talking to you about middle atmosphere chemistry, a research theme at PEARL, which you've heard mentioned a number of times today. And so this is going to be more of a kind of a top-level talk. My goal here is really to let you know what we're doing and planning to do at Eureka with regard to middle atmosphere chemistry measurements. So I'll give you a little bit of an overview of kind of the whole PEARL effort, and then kind of focus in on this particular research theme, and then I'll show you a few results as well. So this is obviously a team of many people. Some of them are here in the audience today. I won't list all the names, but it's really a group effort. So I'll give you a little bit of background. I think probably I don't really need to do this, but for completeness, a little bit on post-atmospheric ozone trends and the need for Arctic measurements, and then talk to you about PEARL, as I mentioned, and then focus on this theme. And in terms of the measurements, it'll be a little bit of a mix of some of our very recent results, just kind of off the computer in the last week or so, and then some things that we've been working on over the last few years, and then give you a little bit of an outlook for where we hope to go over the next year or two. Okay. So this is a map from the 2002 ozone assessment, so a little out of date, but I like it because it kind of shows very clearly in a colorful picture the trends in Arctic ozone. This is from satellite data from TOMS and GOLM for the period from 1978 to 2000, showing you the ozone decrease with a trend in the Arctic of about 1% or so per year in the spring, in March, and showing you this is the these X's mark the position of the vortex edge, and so showing you the chemical ozone loss inside the polar vortex. From the more recent assessment, the 2006 assessment, this shows you latitudinal trends, and you can see that from 1980 to about 2004, looking here at Eureka being about 80 degrees north, you're seeing a trend on the order of a couple percent based on the observations here in black, and then a sequence of model simulations ranging kind of around that between kind of 1 and 4% at the latitude of Eureka. In terms of predictions, as you heard this morning, we aren't really expecting, basically we're expecting a recovery of ozone over the next 10 to 20 years or so. Ozone should be turning around the Arctic. Again, this is from 2006 ozone assessment. Here we're looking at ozone from 60 north to 90 degrees north, and the data here in black going up to the present day, and then the range of various simulations and what they're predicting, and kind of the recovery here somewhere in this period down around 2020 or soon after. So clearly there could be some perturbations, for example, large volcanic eruptions. There's a whole issue of coupling to stratospheric cooling, and again, we heard about that this morning. And basically not predicting extreme Arctic ozone loss, but there's certainly, I think, a need for measurements to see exactly how the ozone recovery compares with those model predictions. So a couple of quotes here I thought were kind of very cogent and to the point from the IGOS 2004 Atmospheric Chemistry Report. They say that the frequency of measurements deep in the Arctic vortex remains low. The situation is unsatisfactory given the highly nonlinear sensitivity of Arctic stratospheric ozone to cold winters. Chemical and dynamical perturbations caused by strong volcanic eruptions make it impossible to derive a linear trend in total ozone, which highlights the importance of continuous measurements throughout the expected recovery of the ozone layer during the coming decades. So I think I'm probably preaching to the converted here. I'll just add one more quote, put this one in for Ted. I expect Ted has something to do with this one, but with regard to the Arctic, the future evolution of ozone is potentially sensitive to climate change and to natural variability, and will not necessarily follow strictly the chlorine loading. This uncertainty there is uncertainty in even the sign of the dynamical feedback due to well-mixed greenhouse gas changes, and progress will result from further development of chemistry climate models and from comparisons of results between models and observations. And I think that's very much the theme of the workshop this week. So that leads straight into motivation for PEARL. As you've heard, PEARL is a Polar Environment Atmospheric Research Laboratory. It was formerly Environment Canada's Arctic Stratospheric Ozone Observatory, which was set up in 1993. And it was taken over in summer of 2005 by CANDAC, which is I'll talk a bit more about in a moment. So Eureka's up here on Ellesmere Island, as you heard earlier, 80 degrees north, 86 west, and about 15 kilometers from Environment Canada's weather station, the main lab up on this ridge at about 600 meters on elevation. So PROLIS being run and operated by CANDAC, the Canadian Network for Detection of Atmospheric Change. This is a kind of group of researchers who kind of came together a few years ago to try and coordinate our measurements and study of the changing atmosphere over Canada. So the initial emphasis is on the Arctic. Environment Canada mothballed ASTRO in 2002, and so there was kind of an immediate concern and drive to try and reverse that decision, and we've been quite successful in getting funding for new equipment and science, at least for 5 years. What happens after that remains to be seen. So at Eureka, we have effectively three labs. There's a little bit of confusion. PROLIS is kind of the overall station, but it's also the lab up on the hill, the red building that you've seen in a number of pictures. Then there's OPAL, which is our zero altitude lab, made out of a number of seatainers, and SAPPHIRE, which is a new lab being set up a couple kilometers away from these other two, and has a flux tower and a baseline radiation station and some other instrumentation. And there's also a dedicated satellite link, the most northerly one in the world, I believe. So in terms of CANDAC goals, you know, very high, fairly high level, the idea here is to coordinate research-type atmospheric measurements in Canada, to integrate data from a number of different platforms, to develop quality control protocols for data, that's a huge issue, and then also to kind of build on PEARL, our kind of big goal is to try and have a number of similar stations across the country, which we are fondly calling anchor points. The kind of very general goals of PEARL are to study the atmosphere from the ground to about 100 kilometers, whereas ASTRO, the predecessor, was very much focused on just the stratosphere. Our goal here is to do measurements from the troposphere up through the mesosphere, focusing on the kind of the usual topics. Looking at research-grade equipment, so we're also kind of developing some techniques and doing some new things there, developing new instrumentation and observing strategies, and then continuing to provide a Canadian presence at this location, about 1,000 kilometers from the North Pole. So the way we've organized the science for PEARL, we've divided things into four research themes. The first one is Arctic troposphere transport and air quality, and Jim Sloan, who's here at the meeting, is the theme leader for that. Then there's Arctic radiative environment, focusing on clouds and aerosols and diamond dust and their impacts. Tom Duck at Dalhousie is the theme leader for that. Middle atmosphere chemistry in the Arctic, that's what I'll be talking about in this presentation. And then waves and coupling processes, and William Ward, who's here, has a poster, is the theme leader for that topic. We also involve in other activities, satellite validation, for example, and also looking at sudden events as they occur. This is a fairly long list of instrumentation. I'm not going to go through it in detail, but just to give you an idea of the kind of scope of the instrumentation that's going in, I've underlined the kind of five instruments that are most relevant to the chemistry measurements, but we have instruments measuring everything from winds to temperatures and many other properties of the atmosphere as well. So the middle atmosphere chemistry theme is aiming to try to answer a number of science questions. The first one is fairly basic: what is the chemical composition of the Arctic stratosphere above PEARL, and how and why is it changing with time? How is the chemistry coupled to dynamics, microphysics, and radiation? What's the polar stratospheric bromine budget? This is a source of some uncertainty, and the BRO and CLO cycle estimate to contribute to about half of the chemical ozone loss in the Arctic. The other question is, of course, how will the polar stratosphere respond to climate perturbations, and particularly while chlorine and bromine loading is high? How will changes in atmospheric circulation affect polar ozone? And then will there be a cooling and more ozone depletion, or warming and less in the polar regions? So there are five primary instruments that will contribute to the chemistry measurements. Our goal is to combine these with data, obviously, from the other instruments, from the LIDARs and temperature measurements and so on as well. They all are all needed to give you the big picture. But in terms of doing the chemistry measurements, these are the instruments. There's a Brooker 125 HR Fourier transform spectrometer, which works in the infrared from about 700 to 4500 wave numbers in its kind of a baseline configuration. It has very high spectral resolution, which allows us to resolve spectral lines, and that does direct solar and we hope, lunar measurements. We have a UVisible spectrometer, which looks at zenith scatter light, and we're building a sun tracker to also do direct solar absorption, working from about 300 to 600 nanometers. There's a stratospheric ozone LIDAR, which you just heard about from Rich. That's a dial LIDAR. There's a Brewer instrument from Environment Canada, which says ozone total columns. And then we're installing an emission interferometer that looks at infrared emission from about 3 to 25 microns, calibrated radiant spectra, which are of great interest to the radiation theme, but we're interested in trying to derive some trace gas measurements. It'll be low resolution. We won't have any height information, but at least get total columns. And the advantage of this is that because it's emission, you can do measurements through polar night, whereas these top two instruments really require sunlight, so there's no data from late October to late February. So with this combination, we can measure quite a suite of species. I won't read them all out. But we get most of the components of the nitrogen and chlorine budgets, for example. And we primarily get total columns, some information on vertical distribution from the spectrometers. Obviously, the dial gives better vertical resolution for the ozone profiles. But for heavy gases, we might get something like up to four or five independent pieces of information, which are Mercury profiles, but they're not all independent layer by layer. So it's been fairly busy for the last year or so. Just to give you an idea of kind of what we've been doing, we had a number of validation campaigns for the ACE mission, and you'll hear more about that from Kaylee just after me. We installed a search array while waiting for our own Candac 1 to be installed. That was in March 2006. We put the new Booker in last summer and the new UVVisible 1 in shortly thereafter, and so got our first data from those instruments about a year ago. We had another validation campaign for ACE this past spring. And then one thing we want to do with the Booker is have it certified as part of NDAC, which is the Network for Detection of Atmospheric Composition Change. The existing Bowman instrument, which I'll come back and talk to you about more in just a moment, is an NDAC certified instrument. So we really need to kind of map the calibration of the old one to the new. And so we had a dedicated campaign for Rebecca up in Eureka in July, doing a very large number, I think over 600 spectra, to give us a good feeling for how we can transfer the standard from the old instrument to the new one. Right now, we're involved in an oral evaluation campaign as part of NDAC, and Radhika Lindemeyer, one of our graduate students, is up in Eureka right now. And so ongoing, obviously, we're doing daily measurements as well as implementing and optimizing our retrieval algorithms, particularly for the infrared instrument. This is a fairly complex retrieval process, so getting kind of data up, columns and profiles up in near real time is something we would love to do, but we're not there yet. And you can talk to Rebecca about all the nitty-gritty details of actually getting some of these retrievals out. So as an advertisement, if you haven't already, you can certainly see hear more about the infrared data from Rebecca and the UVisible instrument from Anne Marie, who both have posters here this week. So I thought I'd just show you a few results just to give you a feel for the kind of measurements that we're getting that might be of interest for data simulation or comparisons with models. This is our UVisible spectrometer, a grading instrument with an array detector. So this is a nice file. I like this one a lot. We've been doing measurements with UVisible instruments at Eureka since 1999. I've been sending people up. I think Elham went up in spring of 2000, our second year, and for a number of years thereafter. And then Anne-Marie's been going up the last few years. And so we've always done measurements here in spring. So we've usually gone up in mid-February and done measurements for a month or two as the sun's come back. But this is the first time we've actually been able to done measurements with this type of instrument in the fall. And so we've always kind of seen some variation on NO2 recovering in the spring as you have more sunlight and being released from N2O5 reservoir. And there can be some complication depending on what the vortex is doing. For example, here, the vortex was over Eureka through most of March. But you can basically see this kind of recovery with some variability. Variations, and then now we can actually see the decrease in the fall. So this is the first time we've actually measured this from the ground at Eureka, so we're kind of pleased with how it's come out. So here you've got NO2 basically decreasing as the sunlight's decreasing and being converted to into a 5 reservoir. What we'd like to do, of course, is fill this gap, and we may be able to do that with lunar measurements with our infrared spectrometer or with the emission instrument. You can also do a couple of instruments like this to a telescope and do measurements with stars, and we've done a little bit of that, but haven't done it in earnest at Eureka. Something that we could think about for the future. And this is a similar thing for ozone, showing you measurements with the Pearl instrument here. So the Pearl one is the one that's been installed. The UT one is its forerunner, the one that's been up there now for 8 or 9 campaigns. And for about a week or so, we had the two working in parallel and looking at the agreement between them. And then we switched over with the Pearl one to look focus on the BRO region. So we no longer had ozone measurements. And you can see here where this decline, it corresponds to when the polar vortex came right over Eureka. So you can see Anne-Marie's poster if you want to hear more about the details of those measurements. So on the infrared side, as I mentioned, there's a BOMEM instrument up there, and that's been there for about 14 years now. It's difficult. We have one on the roof of the physics building. This is a slightly earlier version. It's rather difficult to automate, and our goal is to really have our instruments and measurements automated as much as possible. And so the plan is to gradually phase this one out and replace it with a kind of state-of-the-art Bruker instrument, which is what this is. The other thing that we've deployed at Eureka for the last 4 years, I guess, is the PALS instrument, which is an adaptation of the ACE Fourier transform spectrometer. And for this particular campaign, the most recent one, we had for the first time all three of these working in parallel. I'm not going to talk too much about the comparison campaign, but just to kind of, I'm going to mention PALS again in a few moments, and also the BOMEM, so this just shows you those three instruments. These two here are very high spectral resolution instruments, which means you can resolve the infrared line shapes. And by fitting to those, because they depend on pressure and temperature, you can get some height information. PALS is lower resolution by about a factor of 10 or so, and that means that you don't resolve the line shapes so well, but you can do a measurement much more quickly. And as you'll see in a few moments, there are kind of advantages to that as well. And so you get very good temporal resolution with PALS. But you don't get such good vertical resolution. So we've been having a very nice collaboration with Hans Fast and Richard Mittermeier at Environment Canada, who've been operating the BOMEM instrument since 1993. As I mentioned, that's a part of NDAC, part of the NDAC Arctic Primary Station. And so our goal as part of our collaboration with them is to go back and reanalyze this full VA8 data set, which up to now has really only been analyzed to get total column amounts, but not trying to get any kind of vertical height information. So we've been working with them to implement this vertical profile retrieval to get partial columns and mission ratio profiles. And I won't bore you with the details, but there's a number of inputs that we spent a fair bit of time trying to optimize. And to start with, we've been focusing on data from the last few years, which is when we've had these ACE validation campaigns. So interpreting measurements from Eureka, it can be complex because what's happening is a direct sun measurement is you're basically tracking the sun through the day, and the sun is moving, and the vortex is not everywhere at the same time. So as an example, let me explain this figure to you. Eureka is here, okay, and then this is distance kind of along its arc. So the outermost arc is 600 kilometers away, so there's distance 600, 500, 400, etc. So we're going up to 600 kilometers away from Eureka, and then looking at angles from due east through to west. Okay, so here's Eureka up here. Here's Resolute Bay, almost, not quite, but almost due south. Okay, and here you can see the advantage of the kind of high temporal resolution of this PALS spectra measurements. You can see, in blue we have all the PALS measurements that were made on a single day, I think March 3rd of 2004. So you've got them kind of all through the day. Whereas the DA8 is doing much less frequent measurements, also has swapped through a number of filters. And so on this particular day, we've got 3 DA8 spectra, a couple in the morning and one in the afternoon. Okay. So in the meantime, the vortex may be over here or maybe over here. And so you may get variations through the day that are kind of can be real things in the atmosphere, but can depend on exactly where you're looking. And we certainly had that in 1 year, actually with our UV visual instrument. We were looking into the vortex at one point and out of it at the other, and you can see very clear differences in ozone. Then we're looking at doing validation of ACE, and so, for example, you think, well, an ACE occultation within 200 kilometers of Eureka would be better than one within 500, But in fact, I didn't. So these are the what we're sampling the stratosphere with these infrared measurements at 25 kilometers. So in fact, base occultation that's within 500 kilometers is actually closer to the infrared measurements. Okay, so if you look at these things in carefully, you can take into account exactly where you're looking and when. This is a busy plot. I realize this. I won't go into all the detail. The idea here is that we have a total column of ozone for 2 years, 2004 and 5, in blue and red, from the VA8, Paris, and ACE. As I said, I won't go into details, but we have this is the time series from day 55 through to day 70. What I'd like to do is just focus on this little circle here, which is blown up on the side. And when we first started comparing the VA8 and Paris data for purposes of ACE validation, we were finding that they were quite different. And we were looking at daily means. And as you can see here, we have a DA8 measurement in the morning, just kind of square, and then you have Paris measurements coming up and kind of turning over and coming back down through the course of the day. Another DA8 measurement here. So you can imagine if we take a daily mean of these two points, it's going to be down here somewhere, whereas the daily mean of the Paris measurements will be somewhere up here. And so, of course, they're going to disagree. So we kind of look by looking more carefully at the evolution of the measurements over the course of just a single day, we were able to show that, in fact, the DA8 measurements are agreeing very well with Paris, and giving us some confidence in those data. Another thing that we're doing is looking at the 2004 and 5 years, because they were quite different over Eureka. 2004 was fairly warm, 2005 fairly cool, and you can see, for example, the very large differences in this case, in HCl, where you've got chlorine activation and so much lower HCl in the cold 2005 winter. And we have similar measurements for most of the other species in the chlorine and nitrogen families, but in the interest of time, I won't go into all those here. So this is just to give you a feel for the kind of thing that we would want to do with our Brooker measurements. This is some work that Ellie did as part of her PhD. And what she did was combine data from the Bowman instrument with data which is from Eureka here, there's Black Star, there's Thule in Greenland down here, there's a similar instrument there, and then over in Kiruna in Sweden, there's a similar instrument up there. And so this is showing you a time series from February through April, this is 2002, so going back a few years. And what we had that year was Hans and Richard did lunar measurements with their instrument as well as solar ones, and so we had measurements through the polar night as well. And you can see there's a fair bit of scatter between the Eureka data in black, the Thule data in Greenland in red, and Kiruna here in blue. But if we look at where the vortex was relative to the sites, we can start to understand what's happening here. So, for example, these light green circles, this is Eureka. And you can see here Eureka is inside the vortex, so you have elevated nitric acid, whereas Thule here, much lower, is outside the vortex. And so you can kind of explain that difference in nitric acid by looking at the dynamic situation, whereas a few days later, you can see that those data from Eureka and Thule are much closer agreement. In this case, they're both kind of on the edge of the vortex, so this nitric acid measurement is somewhere between those two extremes. So, and the other thing we've done is looked at, again, the time series. I'm going to focus on the top figure here, but we have Eureka, Thule, and Kiruna. And he did some comparisons with Seaman and also with SimCat. And so what we have in this top figure are some solar measurements from the Bowman instrument. And then we have lunar measurements kind of once a month for roughly a week. And then solar measurements again as the sun returns. And you can actually get a much better picture of what's happening through the winter. And then this dark solid line is Seaman version 7. And then the shaded lines are the 1 sigma variability on that. That's a 20-year run of CMAM. And then in blue, we have a SimCat run on those. So seeing quite nice agreement there between CMAM and those wintertime nitric acid columns. So going back to our Brooker measurements, so remember we have Paris up there as well this past spring. So in red, the red stars here are Paris. This is day 76. We're inside the vortex, so you can see the terrific density over in time. This is time of day from over the course of 2 p.m. to 8 p.m. Universal Time. So we have Taurus all the way through, fairly stable, and then we have a Brooker measurement here, and here, and here, right on top of each other. So that's very nice. Then we get outside the vortex, and you can see that the Brooker measurements now are a little bit higher, or Taurus is lower, depending on who's analyzing the data. But what we think is happening here is this is an artifact of the lower resolution of Taurus. The a priori profile that we feed into the retrieval is on the low side, and we think that in this case, Taurus is being constrained by the a priori. So that's something that we're looking at. This is very recent analysis. But on the whole, we're fairly happy with how those results are agreeing. And then looking at the time series, we've got HF. This is very recent data from Rebecca. Go and see your poster for more details. You can see HF here, HCl, ozone, and then the ratio scaling by HF to get rid of the nanophore effects. Typically, this ratio is around 2.5 in summer, and so we're looking at vortex air as the vortex goes over Eureka in March. So this is the kind of data that we hope to have throughout IPY and beyond, and is available for comparisons with models and so forth. Just to wrap up, outlook. I think we probably all hopefully agree that long-term measurements are essential to understanding the chemical state of the Arctic stratosphere and how it's changing with time. And that's obviously the focus of our middle atmosphere chemistry theme at Eureka. Our instruments are in place, except for the area, the Canadac area, will go in next spring or early summer. In the meantime, we have this one on loan from CERT and NOAA. So we're now looking towards getting those two instruments certified for NDAC. And then we're looking at installing a neutron tracker for both instruments to help us with automation. We're looking at upgrading the ozone LiDAR and installing the Canadac ARRI, as I mentioned. We're also working to integrate our measurements with those of other instruments at Pearl. It's been a very busy summer up there. Quite a number of instruments have gone in over the last month or two. And as those data streams come online, we'll certainly be comparing with those. And then obviously trying to contribute to IPY atmospheric science. So I think I'll leave it there, and I'd be happy to take questions.